Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 392. We are waist deep in Geek Week over at the Nerdist channel on YouTube and a lot of channels that came together to create Geek Week programming. Go over to YouTube.com/Nerdist right now to see CM Punk's Grammar Slam, which was essentially a show that we jokingly came up with when he came on the podcast, and then he made it. CM Punk goes through tweets and corrects your awful, awful grammar right now on the Nerdist channel on YouTube. Go to YouTube.com/Nerdist and check it out. I'd like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, Adult Swim, new episodes of Children's Hospital with Rob Corddry and NTSF SDSUV star Paul Scheer come out every Thursday night at midnight. I'm a big fan of the show. If you listen to this podcast, I'm guessing you are probably a big fan of the show because the two Venn diagrams of those audiences are probably almost a solid circle. So check that out every Thursday at midnight, Adult Swim's Children's Hospital. Thanks to Adult Swim for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. This was recorded during Comic-Con. It was the very last thing that I did at Comic-Con. It was the Sunday. I did some panels and then drove out to Solano Beach, which is just outside of San Diego, to go to the Belly Up Tavern to record one of my favorite bands, Rogue Wave. I adore Rogue Wave. Asleep at Heaven's Gate is one of my all-time favorite albums. And Descend Like Vultures as well. I would put both of those up in there. Their new album is called Nightingale Floors. They happen to be incredibly nice guys. I podcasted Zach and Pat, who's also in the band. So here you go. This is from the Belly Up Tavern in Solano Beach. Our good friends now, Rogue Wave, on the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 392. Podcast.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
It's like a taser of some kind.
It does look like a taser.
Yeah, TSA does not like these devices.
Wow. Yeah. I got a little something here ready to do a little check for you here, a little sound check. Let's see. Come on, YouTube.
I like the drilling things in the Matrix, you know, the Sentinel thing.
Yes.
I want to yell at this thing, like, come on. You know, like Louis C.K. It only has to go to outer space and back.
Yeah.
To space. Oh, here we go.
Hi there. My name is Ken Tamplin. Oh, baby. Would you like to have that kind of vocal power, range, clarity, and pitch? Well, you can. Come join me, KenTamplinVocalAcademy.com, and I'll show you how we can do it.
Okay.
He's so
good?
Pleasant.
Yeah, I want to learn from him. I've watched some of his videos, and he'll go show you how to sing like Michael Jackson. And you're like,
can you do it?
He does it, but he's got this weird thing where he really sticks his tongue out really far when he does.
Can you do it?
Sing like Michael Jackson?
No,
I can't. Sing like Kent?
No.
No, I can only try to imitate it. I can only wish. I mean, maybe if I go to the Institute.
Then maybe you actually learn how to do
that. Yeah,
it's not easy.
Usually his students are learning like Journey songs. No offense.
He and I have a bit of a... disagreement.
Wait, okay, so this is...
So, and it's been lasting a long time.
Welcome to Journey Court, where today we're going to solve the ultimate question of... I don't know what the Journey issue is, but obviously one of you is on one side,
clearly.
One of you is on the other.
Clearly.
And so I kind of want to just think of me as a Journey mediator. And we'll take together a journey.
Well, should we explain there's a more second to half it? To this. It's journey versus kiss. So okay. I'm firmly in the journey camp.
Sure.
Where journey is superior. They're better songwriters, better songs. Mm-hmm. And he's firmly firmly in the kiss camp.
Mm-hmm. You're and in the kiss camp?
I think that's unforgivable, and it's caused a lot of debate. We've even taken it to the social media
sphere. We took it
sphere,
to the streets.
Who won?
And I Journey won.
The digital
there
streets.
Was some, there was kiss support, but...
There was some good... I mean, you know, Kiss was fun. They had some good songs. They're sort of a fun...
Cartoonishly fun.
Cartoonishly funny. A fun party band.
Mm-hmm. They wrote very wholesome lyrics.
You're talking about Beth?
Yeah, Beth. The and, only. Let's see. Beth.
Yeah.
It's also...
Beth was a good one.
Beth was great. Yeah. And they did a good cover, but I don't remember what it's called. But Beth was a really nice song. Very pretty. It's a road song, you know?
But Beth, song, yeah. Beth isn't Faithfully, which is Faithfully fucking amazing road song.
See, I feel like we were already tipped the scales. We've tipped the scales.
No, no one else from Journey came out and sang. It was all about Steve Perry. That's true. Peter was it was Peter Criss, right? Yeah. Peter Criss.
He wrote their biggest hits.
So I know that he would, in the shows, he would walk from behind the drums and be like, look, I do this too. I'm the sensitive cat.
And he would say, I'm the sensitive cat, literally. And he'd sit with a rose and sing Beth. It was so cheesy.
Without a shred of irony, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, in a get-up.
You know, open arms. I mean, I just gotta...
My arms are raised. And let me pose this question.
Okay.
If at the height, or actually, okay, not in the height, but if at some point in Kiss's career, if Paul Stanley decided to, get rid of the makeup and walk away from the band, do you think that they could find some young Filipino upstart to front Kiss? I don't think so. Journey...
Let's look it up and see if we can find a man.
There's got to be a young man.
Kiss could just be like the Dread Pirate Roberts and just be handing
around... Yeah, the makeup really
the
helps.
The title and the makeup, forever. So that's true. There could be... another Kiss.
Maybe there has been, and we don't know.
It's like Paul McCartney, probably, when he died.
When he died. For some reason, that movie... That weird documentary keeps coming up in my Netflix queue. Netflix thinks I want to watch... This guy made a documentary where he claims to have all this evidence and proof that Paul is actually... I think it might be called Paul is Dead. Mm-hmm. That Paul did die and that the clues are all there, man. But I haven't seen it yet.
I thought you were going to say something about the documentary Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park.
No.
Like right after the Destroyer. That was a very good documentary about them.
They were replaced by robots, right?
Right. And in an amusement park.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow. I can see that happening.
This guy is that apparently the Paul McCartney that we know is not the actual Paul McCartney. That's just another guy.
Well, that's like that George Lucas thing that was going around. Did you see like the fake trailer for a movie of that George Lucas was kidnapped, and that's where it all went wrong when the Phantom Menace started. That actually it was an imposter, George Lucas, who totally changed Star Wars, and that's the reason why everything went awry.
Well,
and he was trapped, and like they had the same beard and like the same weird neck thing that's happening there. That I don't know why he doesn't have someone to advise against it.
He's turning into one of his own characters.
I like that. That's how passionate Star Wars fans are, that they will actually write fan fiction about the creator himself. Just because why not? But I have just left Comic-Con. I almost pretty much came from my last panel at Comic-Con right to Solana Beach because we've never met before, but I am such a huge Rogue Wave fan and have been for years, and I was turned on to you by David Cross in 2008, maybe. Mm. You guys were playing in San Francisco, and we were all doing SF Sketchfest.
Mm. Yeah.
And you guys were there. And he was like, it's a fucking great band. And I started listening right there, and just every song, every album, I'm such a huge fan.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, you'd never know from David Cross if he was a fan of your work.
My jaw is dropped.
I remember when we did that Tinkle with them, that was a really fun act. That's when we met Eugene Merman that night.
Eugene Merman and Bob Odenkirk.
Met Bob night, too.
We had dinner with them afterwards at this Chinese
place. Yeah. I was at one of the other tables. Like, there was a huge group of people.
That was a horrible place.
It was supposed to be the best Chinese food.
I was frightened. Eugene was eating something that looked like it was squid-like, but it had tentacles, but it didn't look like it was...
Now,
anything someone should eat.
Tell me if you do this. When I'm on the road
I tend to not eat risky foods in kind of dodgy looking places,
like
because
raw foods or cooked or
yeah, well, just sort of anything, like a food yeah. that I can't really identify when it when the place is kind of like it's a little the floors are a little dirty, you know, just because I'm always terrified that because if you get food poisoning on the road, yeah, there's really not much you can you have to cancel show.
Go to the bathroom. We've experienced that, you know, on our last album cycle, we were on the road and. Our bass player, our former bass player and keyboard player, they thought it'd be a good idea. We were somewhere in the Midwest, or somewhere, we were on our way to New Orleans, where they decided they would try this all-you-can-eat Chinese food buffet. And it was
looked, big, red,
it
block
had,
letters,
not
China.
Even all the lights were illuminated. It looked wrong.
Right.
And they're like, what's the worst that could happen? So our bass player got food poisoning, and he was vomiting, and it was all the things you don't want to happen. He looked green, and he was in the dressing room. We're like, okay, how do we play tonight? Because you can barely move, you know?
Right.
And so our keyboard player he's like, actually, that's not realized. He was pretty good. He said, well, what songs are we going to do tonight? And he kind of looks at the set list. He's like, all right. Like, all right, what? He's like, I'll do it. And he played bass and keys at the same time.
Oh, shit.
It was amazing.
And then that's when you kicked the other guy out of the band.
I know. I was like, I could save a lot of money
you
here.
You could. And he makes bad choices. He actually really.
Yeah.
He rallied for the encore because he was like, man, my job's in danger if I don't get off this thing.
He did like so the home run trot, you know, looking awful, then collapsed.
I think
later
that's he probably put a diaper on and came down.
I'm sure.
What you have to do is run a cable all the way to the bathroom floor in the toilet, and he can just lie on the ground with headphones and listen and just play along with you guys.
Like, yeah. Well, I injured myself really bad once, and we had promised to do this compilation recording. I slipped a couple discs in my neck, and I was in a lot of pain. I couldn't move, and so we felt bad because it was this some compilation. They'd already booked the time. We promised, and I felt at the time like I had to do it.
Yeah.
So it was in San Francisco, Tiny Telephone. If you know, that's John Vanderslice's studio.
Okay.
So it's great, and we go there, and they had to lay ice packs across the floor, and I lay it on my back, and he played guitar for me. I couldn't do it, but I got to play the keyboard, but I had to lay on my back to do it, and I play like this, and they had to put the microphone up, you know, like that, and so we were able to get it done, but sometimes you just have to.
How'd you eke the voice out when you're compressed on your back like that?
I sang really quiet, but it worked. It totally worked. It made the song, actually, and his guitar, he plays guitar different than I do. Pat does, so...
That's one of those crazy things where if you were like, because first of all, I mean, just talking about Kiss and Journey or whatever, I mean, I think of Journey as more of an 80s band, but they really also were a 70s band as well.
They kind of transcend
time and space.
They have Steve Perry as their singer at first, right? Right.
Originally.
Right.
Let's talk about their golden.
Okay.
Cool. See, where are you going now? Well, I was saying just that period of all the times where it seems like it would be really great to have been in a band, it seems like the 70s. No one, like, people didn't care about, no one was really self-conscious about anything. Mm-hmm. People were fucking everything, doing every kind of drug.
They ruined it for us.
They ruined, yeah, exactly. Their lives, you know, they were basically just had, it's like the Joe Walsh song, you know, because they have this endless supply of money that they don't know where it's coming from.
They're probably 185, that one.
I lost my license, so I can't drive.
Yeah.
They're being funded by their labels. They have no idea how much money they have. They live these crazy... That's one of those things where that guy from that 70s band would be like, from now on, man, I gotta record all my songs on an ice pack on my back. And then he would only ever perform that way ever again.
Yeah, well, I've thought about that too. We've come up with ways sometimes to try and reproduce ways where it worked in the past. Like, we did one song about insomnia. So the guy we're working with, he told me to... We were at the studio where every room was kind of wired. Mm-hmm. It's where Flaming Lips record.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's a studio. And so it's all about insomnia. So he said, I want you to get into the bed that you're sleeping in. And he filled my mouth with cotton balls. And I had to sing it laying down like I was in bed, unable to sleep. And I'll be damned, it totally worked. And it sounded cool. And we've tried. Then I was like, all right, let's try the cotton ball thing sometimes. It really works because you can't enunciate anything, but you get the kind of the roundness of your voice.
Yeah.
And it kind of forces you to just be completely restrained in your singing, you know? So it's kind of
But
cool
then
thing.
Did you do a track of consonants over top of that?
Yeah,
that
so we took... It was like the... It was a whisper track.
Yeah.
Which we ended up trying. But, you know, I wanted to say...
Did it go like this? You will like our penis.
Yeah.
You will like our... Penises. You will like our penises? Yeah.
You know the Bing Bong Brothers?
Bing Bong Brothers.
What I was going to say is, you know, talking about how times have changed, you know, and... I was thinking earlier today that we were going to be doing the podcast with you today, and I think it's interesting because for a lack of, you know, nerd culture or what you do and what your podcast is about and your show and everything. And one thing that I like about what you do is back in the day when things were popular, it was like cool to like popular music. It was right. cool to like huge bands and to love them, to know everything about them. And we've seen a lot of changes in music business, obviously. But one thing that I find frustrating about today is that it's somehow not cool to like things that are popular. It's not cool to like things and worship them. And what I like about, again, for lack of a better word, nerd culture is it's cool to love a huge thing like Star Wars. It's okay to embrace it. It's not, you know, it's, there's joy in that. There's so much joy in worshiping things, yeah. you know? And I really like that. And I feel like a lot of times there's in indie rock in our kind of space, sometimes there's kind of you feel like you're not on the inside of it and, you know, you can't know about this. And we try to make ourselves a little inclusive so it's kind of closer to nerd culture, where it's good to like things and it's great to enjoy them and embrace them.
Yeah, you know? And that's an excellent point, because I think in the 80s, when there was no irony yet, you know, things just were what they were, right. and you could just like something just because, not for any ironic reason. Mm-hmm. Like, look how fucking ridiculous this thing is. And now there is that sort of layer of irony. It's like the counterculture sort of, I think, sprang out of the 80s. Out of the moist loins of the 80s came this sort of, you know, that this pop culture, this counter pop culture that then I think has now become so much of a counterculture that it's almost counterculture to be able to like things again, mm-hmm. unironically, and include people and celebrate things and not be ashamed to just like stuff.
People are liking Taylor Swift now. Like, hipsters are starting to like Taylor Swift, and our guitar player now claims that he likes Katy Perry.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, he'll tell you.
I think people are coming around on the Miley train. She cut her hair off. She's doing some punk stuff, you know, singing Jolene. Sounding pretty good.
She is? Really?
She did these backyard sessions. Do you know... Is that the train?
That is. Yeah. That's the...
That's the apocalypse, actually.
Yeah.
Is that the train?
You know, I used to live on this street, actually, so I used to hear that train.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
You lived on right here in Solana Beach?
I lived on Cedros, on this street.
This is a little bit of coming home for you.
Yeah, I love coming here because it reminds me of the days when I truly had no responsibilities at all. We brewed beer in our garage, got high every day, went to the beach, hung out, played music. No one came.
Yep.
I played the Velvet and the Casbah, every club. And so it's kind of fun to be.
So how do you? So I'll get back to my. I'll get back to what I was saying in a sec, because now you've got me on a whole another thing, which is. This might be a Star Trek reference. I don't know if you guys know, but you're essentially stuck in this kind of beach nexus. You're in this nexus, this ribbon of just pure looped happiness, which seems to be like what you said, brewing beer in the garage, going to the beach, hanging out, doing whatever. So what was it that eventually made you go, yeah, I should probably get out of the garage and go do stuff and take some responsibility?
Playing in a band, right?
Well, no. That honestly, I lived here and I felt like... I know I was playing music, but no one came to see us play. We played the Del Mar Fair and did stuff, but there was nothing really happening. And the music scene at the time felt very, very small to me, and we weren't really part of it.
Yeah.
And I decided, hey, I want to go to Europe. So I just packed up. My girlfriend and I just decided to go to Europe until we ran out of money. And that's, we just kind of went for it, and then just ended up... When we ran out of money, realizing that we actually had to earn money again, and so we moved back home with our parents, and then I moved to San Francisco and then got started with my life.
So, first of all, how much money and how long did it take to blow through it?
It took about 4 months to blow through. Gosh, I don't know. We were really doing the hostels and not spending right. anything, you know. But I don't know. It was a while ago. I have to ask. Probably like... $5,000.
So you lived on $5,000 for 4 months.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
It's not bad. But when it was gone, we were like, what in the hell are we going to do? We knew we had the money. We already paid for the... That's what we were just talking about. We knew we had a plane ticket home. And I also could tell it was time to come home because we were hanging out in Paris with my friend. And he had a friend there who was a little hard of hearing and was a hairdresser. And he said he wanted to do something cool to my, he had a, like an idea he wanted to do. And so I said, all right, you know, what's the worst that could happen?
Okay.
And so he started doing some cutting, and we were drinking wine, and I was sort of paying attention while, but it was very social. And he at some point there was tinfoil, and I didn't know what that was for. And then, he was cutting and doing things. And, after a while, it really started to hurt. It's like this burning sensation. And then he finally took it off, and he's like, well, what do you think? You know, and clearly when I was saying what I wanted, that wasn't getting through. I think he couldn't hear me, and I didn't know what he was saying. So he took it off, and all along the bottom of my hair was shaved, and the top kind of went, it almost like a nipple, it was like a sprout.
Nipple?
Kind of, yeah. It was like angled. It was like a point. Like Tintin or something, mm-hmm, yep. And it was completely white.
Oh!
So he bleached it completely white at an angle. It was like a finger pointing in one direction.
Oh!
And that was my hair. And
did you end up
and so I knew
like this?
Yeah, it looks so so strange.
Did you shave it all off after that?
Well, I didn't want to insult him, so I waited till I got back to the States. Wanted to freak out my parents first.
Yeah.
You know, and they said, "My God, what have you done?
I've changed, yeah, Europe."
Yeah, and so, and then I, you know, but it had to wait till it grew out because it was completely bleached, like
you
a shock of white.
You should have brought a special hat that went over the nipple.
Yeah, I look like, yeah, like, I look
this
like powder.
Is why I have this. It's like that character in Oz.
That, yeah, with the little hat that would just stick that would there. Some yep. magically stay on. Yep. He was Mr. Echo, right?
Yeah,
on Lost.
On Lost, yeah.
Did I read that you first? Were you a victim of the .com? If you were up in Northern California, there is a very good chance that you work somewhere in or near the tech sector.
Yeah, I mean, it was easy to get a job. You know, everyone I knew was doing it, and we were getting paid more than we should have. To you know, it was a lot of hard work. I was there kind of all the time.
To do what? And where was it?
I was in San Francisco. It was like a web development company. Yeah. So we built software and you know front end web design stuff and. Mm-hmm. Bunch of did a lot of stuff, but I was just a project manager.
Yeah,
you know? And so I had to tell the designers and you know when they were, you know, I needed them to get their stuff done, and I had to tell the engineers and I need to make sure everything was integrated properly and meet with clients, you know, and tell them and when they'd say stuff like, yeah, we want to make we do cosmetics, we want to be able to smell stuff. Like, okay, well, you can't do that yet.
Can we smell our website?
Yeah, that doesn't work yet.
Why can't we smell our website?
Yeah, that was no, Scratch really asked that. They said they wanted to be able to have that technology. And like, well, that doesn't exist yet, you know, that kind of stuff. And we're getting it done. And
that's
so, yeah,
a serious request. Or they were like, I want, when you see this, to visualize a scent. Or they really wanted
to. They wanted to literally have it be where you could smell.
They literally shit their pants.
They literally shit their pants.
I didn't shit my pants. I literally.
That's the funny thing. You know, we've been playing music for a long time together, and we, because of the out, actually, we were talking about if we've spent more time with our significant others than with each other, you know, over the years, who
sure.
spent more hours together. And but we do, I think, like most bands, we just speak, and sometimes we'll go great lengths only speaking in quote, you know, and it you don't even really realize you're doing it sometimes. And it's totally, if someone were to sit there and listen to our, it would make no sense. We're like going from the frogs to.
I have to apologize to my lady every time I come home. I'm sorry, hon. This is just a new phase in communication with the band. And
oh, it's band talk again,
yeah,
is it?
Sorry, it's inside yeah. stuff. It'll go away. It'll diffuse and it'll go away.
I don't yeah. think there's any question that you probably spend just as much, if not more, time with. I mean, because it's sort of, you know, you're on the road and you're kind of in the trenches and you're going to venues and shit's not right and you got to figure out how to make it work and you're going through stuff together. And
in the early days, we yeah. shared a room. Like we just had the four of us, and in a van, and we'd share a room. Or a living room in someone's house. I mean, really did not.
Or a crack den in Jackson, Mississippi. That was definitely.
Did that happen?
That yeah. was definitely. That was a crack flop house.
There.
I did. And first, I'm like, gosh, yeah, sure. We'll stay there. Thank you so much. I've never been to Jackson, Mississippi.
No, that was St. Louis, I thought.
No, this was Jackson. I remember. It was that dude who had well, I don't want to. But he had that cafe that he was some kind of chef. But
oh,
yeah, come
right.
stay. We got plenty of beds. Cool. Why are there so many beds on the
we
floor? They're just mattresses.
What?
Yeah,
no,
mattresses.
Just beds.
People come in and out, and it was such
really
the crack
the
den.
On holidays.
Like, yeah, that was really gross. But at the time, I mean, there was no money to. We had, you know, if we could stay for free somewhere, we would.
You know? But was your company a casualty of?
Oh, of Doc. Yeah. So I was doing that, and our company got bought by a larger web service because there was all this consolidation that was happening because the bubble had burst and we weren't getting enough new business. So the CEO, the executives wanted to sell because there wasn't enough revenue coming in because they kept growing and we get another floor in the building, you know, get bigger and bigger. And I remember at one time I knew the jig was up because I went onto one of the floors that they decided to consolidate floors just to make better shit. And I went on to the floor and it was basically just a sea of Herman Miller chairs.
Oh, no.
Just like 200 black, you know, the Aeron black ergonomic chairs, just an ocean of black chairs. I was like, okay, things are going to change soon. So they sold it and they let go probably like 95% of the staff and kept like the executives so they could fly their golden parachutes down to the ground. And so at that point I was, and that's really what changed my life because it was such an intense work environment. I was working sometimes like 80 hours a week.
Yeah, but did you have a bar and a restaurant in the,
we had a cafe. Floor? Yes, we did. You could have your free espresso and chocolate croissant and Red Bull at the same time.
The dot-com companies, it morphed into something else, but I think it's still very similar, but there are, you know, maybe there's social media companies now, but there are people and companies who essentially just raise like $100 million, blow through it as fast as possible, and then raise another $100 million for some other company, and it's okay. Like that's what they do.
It's so weird. It's rewarding failure. It's like you lost how much money? We could use something like that here. Come join us. It's crazy. Same with a lot of politicians. You know, like they completely do something, whether it's a scandal or something, but there's somehow it'll morph and just rise again. Yeah. It's almost like they're like, yeah.
I guess it's a whole separate mentality, a whole separate business of just like, no, we just raise money and spend it and go somewhere else, which is very hard for me to wrap my mind around because I think, well, don't, you know, are you supposed to make something or do you have to create? And they're like, oh yeah, you know, it's like everything that they do is all on paper. It looks very good, but there's really nothing going on. But everyone has a personal masseuse and, you know, they have a private chef and, you know, he's making crepes and then it's like...
Why don't we need a crepe maker in the van.
Need a crepe chef.
Yeah, I know. That's the, you know, a tour manager, a crepe chef.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, but, you know, I will say the thing that once I did lose my job, because everyone did, and, you know, I started just playing music, or I was recording music, and I basically... I had nothing. I didn't know what I was doing, so I was recording demos because I was like, "Gosh, I got to get a job," and I just record all these demos. And I knew this guy who had just finished engineering school in Florida, Full Sail. It's like a recording school, and I just sent it to him. You know, like, "Hey, I was working on it," because I'd never recorded my own songs really. And he liked them, and he said, "Hey, I work at the studio in New York, like upstate New York in Woodstock. Just we'll make these demos. Like, let's make real demos." And I said, "Well, let me look at my calendar." Nothing. So,
I've lost everything. Sure.
Yeah, I have no job. Okay. And so I just booked a one-way ticket and flew to New York. I didn't even really know him. And we just recorded this stuff and just completely on the fly. I didn't know. I had never really even recorded, really. And I had stuff on the guitar, but we just plug-ins in, you know, electric guitars, bass, whatever, organs, pianos. And I just do it. It was all on the fly. And that was the first Rogue Wave album. And so I just came home and I realized, looking at, you know, corporate structure and how things kind of work, the thing that drew me to, other than I really liked playing music with Pat, I liked not having that imbalance of, you know, of some CEO at the top kind of pulling the strings. And, you know, we're beholden to an industry, which I understand, but I liked just not living on those terms.
I mean, there's something about, I think, you know, you can put people into two spheres, which is people who like when other people, you know, who they're basically responsible for other people, and then people who are responsible for themselves. You know what I mean? And when you do this and you set off and you make your own stuff and you're a band and you're on the road and you're sort of figuring out yourself or a comedian or whatever, you're responsible. So I kind of like that even the fuck ups you still get to take responsibility over, as opposed to having a CEO who's telling you like, do this, and you know it's wrong, but you do it anyway, and you're like, fuck, not only am I fucking up, but it's not even my fuck up, mm-hmm. that I can't even take responsibility for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of fun to... So I think that's kind of the fun part of it, is being able to take responsibility for everything.
Yeah, it's totally on us, and anytime we figured out how to do things in a smart way, it's always been by fucking up first.
You have to.
Always. And I look back and I think of all the ridiculous stuff we did when we started, you know, and it's always through making a mistake first. And there's something nice about that. And I guess that's why we keep doing it.
You really got into it's interesting that you came out of the .com business and then you entered the music business right as it was starting to get weird. Like, that was the sweet spot of when the music business started to... I mean, I know it really, like, around 2000, 2001, 2002, you know, Napster and LimeWire and all this. But then, you know, 2003, 2004, that's when everything started, where the music business was like, we're powerful! Wait a minute.
Yeah.
The building's shaking.
Yeah, we weird need to sue nice, as many people as possible.
That was a kind word.
He said music industry got weird, which is a very nice way of saying.
Well, it's always been weird. It got, I think...
Extraordinarily weird.
Extraordinarily weird or unstable in a way that it was not prepared for.
But before it got to the point it is now, there was a moment in time, a brief moment in time, when... a lot of bands like ours, you know, were able to license music and have it be, you know, good, where we could really help fund what we were doing. You know, and that still totally exists, but now it's become totally dominated by that. But that's the only way bands make money. You know, but there was that kind of era where we were kind of getting an ability, and not, we didn't care about, you know, it wasn't just to make money, but it was like a means to an end. Like, we could have this revenue come in, we could actually... keep the ball rolling and invest in what we do. And
it used to be called selling out.
Yeah, but
now it's called smart business decisions.
But to us, it wasn't, because, you know, how else can you have the money to, you know, you could do great in Chicago one night, but you could be having a horrible night in Toronto or Iowa City, and if you want to keep the train running, the bus or the van, whatever, you need to have the revenue going all the time.
I think people understand that now more than maybe they used to, and that you can say to them, like, look, this is so that we can be able to create more stuff or be able to tour more, because it is the touring business is a pain. It's hard enough just as a comic to tour, and then we toured the podcast a bit, and it would seem like we, you know, like, oh my god, we're making shit tons of money. But what I think people don't really understand is that when you jump venue size, your overhead costs exponentially grow. And it's like, oh yeah, you have to make, you know, $15,000 just to turn the lights on for one show. And then, you know, you start lumping in all these costs. And, oh, you want a projection screen for something? Well, that's $1,000. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like they start kind of piling all these costs, and there's nothing you can do about it, because it's, you know, that's just the way the business works. And then people complain about, you know, ticket service fees. And you're like, I know, but they work with the promoters and there's no other way for us. Like, it gets really dicey.
Because you
can't carry all the insurance yourself and, you know.
Or other fees. You know, the reason why merchandise costs more and more in larger venues is because the venue takes such a huge percentage.
Like a 30,
of your
like
merch.
30%
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, so if you want to even just cover your cost, you have to. Or there's a lot of things, you know, in our business. Yeah, let's say you make $20,000, you know, for some event. Well, you got to think of all the deductions that taken out before we get anything. You know, your management takes 15%, your booking takes 15%, your lawyer takes 5%, your business manager takes 5%. All these deductions happen, and then you get taxed 50%.
Right.
So when it comes down to, you're like, why do I have $500?
Yeah, it's gonna be made. You're like, wow, that's such a $20,000. That's nice.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
That'd be rent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
if you're lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I guess my point is not that, because obviously we're lucky to do what we do and actually, you know, not take a loss, which we did for a long time. But at the end of the day, you know, my point is that it's not quite the way it looks. Like, oh, you're playing a huge venue, you must be killing it. Like, yeah, I know, but we're kind of just breaking even because it's expensive,
more expensive to
do this. Yeah.
So I got to ask you, how do you like doing the TV show?
What? Which one? The Talking
Nurse,
Dead?
The Nurse,
oh, the Nurse
yeah,
TV
yeah,
show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Talking Dead too, of course. But the new.
It's, well, the Nurse TV show has been amazing because it really, I think, was kind of the soul of what the podcast was, and at least we kind of found that groove in the most recent season. The people that agreed to do the show were insane that we got these guests, like, you know, Guillermo del Toro and Seth Rogen, and it just, it was a crazy, it's been crazy fun. And Talking Dead is, that's just a, that was just a happy accident that, you know, I, whoever would have thought that.
It's genius.
I said after show, and now we're going to do one for Breaking Bad. For the final eight episodes of Breaking Bad.
It's coming out.
To be a little bit more of like a retrospective rather than each episode wrap up, a little bit of that, but also a retrospective, just to sort of give people a little behind the scenes look, you know, through the season. But it's, you know, I don't know. It's, I just left Comic-Con, and the shit that I get to do is silly that, I, that I'm allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. Don't you ever feel like, I don't know, doesn't it ever feel like when you're kind of in a groove and you get to do these really silly, awesome things that you, that someone's just going to go, oh yeah, you're not supposed to do this. You always feel like the guy at the party that security's going to go, excuse me.
Yeah.
What the fuck you doing in here? No, I thought I was my friend. No, sorry, bro.
Yeah, I, you know, when actually when we started, I remember when we started playing as a band, we started doing okay in the Bay Area, getting, you know, people to come see us, you know, not just our friends, you know, and then before we knew it, we were signed to Sub Pop and we were going out with the Shins. And to me, you know, I never even thought about having, I never thought that I'd ever put records out. You know, it was so beyond anything I could comprehend. I didn't feel really worthy of it. I didn't think I had the ability in any way. So when we, it was just such a shock going out, because I loved the Shins, you know, and they had such a massive following to just tour. I didn't really been on tour before, you know, and so I did feel like I was living this parallel life that suddenly I've been like swapped, you know, and it was a really strange experience for me, and it was really at the beginning of what we were doing, but I did have that feeling of like someone's going to say the jig is up at some point, say, okay, all right, the real van that's coming, they're here now, can you guys drive home?
Here's when it really hit home. We were playing these great places with the Shins, sold out, and playing in front of a very enthusiastic crowd. Then on the way home, we stopped at a couple of places in Headland, and there was no one there. You're like, okay, we have a lot of work to do.
Because we hadn't released anything yet. We didn't even have an album out yet.
We were feeling so good about ourselves doing all these great shows. And
we played to the sound engineer in Salt Lake City.
And then the bartender sound engineer and the door guy in Salt Lake City. Yeah, was very...
I did a tour like that with my friend Mike Furman. We had this musical comedy duo and then our friend Reggie Watts, who Reggie's doing really well now.
Yeah.
But I don't know, whatever it was, 8 years ago maybe, or 6, 7 years ago, we did this tour all the Pacific Northwest in San Francisco, and we were playing to like the staff and maybe like 8 or 9 people, but it was still, it's not that I would want to do that forever, but it was really kind of fun at the time, because it really makes you, it makes you focus, it really tests whether or not you care about what you're doing, because if you really care about what you're doing, that doesn't matter. You might get a little frustrated and go, fuck, I wish there were more people here, but it should make you work harder.
Mm-hmm. Well, we always used to just go to the practice space because we just loved playing, and now those shows are a continuation of that. You're just in on a different setting practicing, and there might be a person there, but we still always just like playing for ourselves and to ourselves. But,
so when was the point that it started to that you started showing up to venues and there were people there and you got to be like, was someone else playing? Oh shit, they're here for us.
Yeah, gosh. Well, we were asked. our friend, our former guitar player, he was friends with the guys in Spoon.
Mm-hmm.
He'd kind of known them from growing up.
Brit?
He knew Brit. Yeah, he knew Brit especially. And so, I don't know how he finagled it, but he somehow got us on the bill to be the first of three in San Francisco when they were playing the Fillmore. And so, I certainly had never played the Fillmore before. I mean, couldn't believe it. So, we were first of three, and rarely I found it shows the Fillmore. Is it kind of a packed house when the first of three, it's kind of people trickle in, you know? But something cosmically strange happened that night where it was completely packed with so much energy, and we went on, and I'd say probably 99% of the people probably had never heard of us before, but I of course invited like my whole family, right?
Sure.
And
there's more than 1% of that audience was family of yours. You have a big family.
I do have a big family, but it was one of those nights where we we just came into our own. We recorded it. When we were done, the screaming and the cheering was just unlike some of the could have been the best show we ever had. It was just this thing where it felt like we were something real, like we were a real band. And before we were just like practicing, playing little clubs and stuff like that. But it felt like something crystallized, and everyone in the room seemed to feel it. And we were just like hugging each other because it felt like in my dreams I couldn't have ever had people care about music.
Yeah.
That came from anything that I was doing. And I go upstairs, my family is sobbing, you know, sobbing. They couldn't believe it. It was clear. And so after that moment, we started having people show up, and we played in clubs, and we were selling out. And whenever we played, it was locally became a bigger deal.
I remember when we got that first explosion of crowd. I was just sitting at the drums. I had just put my head down, and I was just like, kind of like had this like shocked look, and I was looking over at Graham, and I was just kind of like, what the hell? I mean, I can still feel that. It's like it was intense.
Then of course, what happens is you immediately go, how the fuck do we do that again? How do we do that again?
You know what happened? We started playing faster and more sloppy because our excitement level just went right through the roof, and we were just like going for it. It was funny.
Because, you know, I think something happens when you get out of a real small club and you go to a bigger room. Like, you can fit about 1,000 people in the Fillmore. And when there's that moment where you're standing, if you're standing in the middle of the stage, and it's kind of like your complete peripheral vision, where it's anywhere you look really straight ahead is an audience, and they have all that energy coming back at you, and you really start expressing yourselves as a band, there's this magical alchemy that I was feeling where it could feel like a fully realized show, not just a club show, but it was something bigger than that. And then As the train rolled by, I realized that it's what I wanted in my life. You know, I wanted that energy, and not people thinking we're so great. Nothing like that. No like ego thing. It was more the feeling you get when you know it only happens that night. You know, that magic in the air when you feel like, you know, all the mistakes we made, if I fell down or we did something, whatever. That's it was, for sure. It was this feeling of, that I got when I was a kid, you know, and I'd go see bands, you know, and so I realized I wanted to be part of it.
I think you just pointed out something that I never actually realized, that I think one of the reasons why I like your music is that there isn't any ego to the songs. It's just sort of like, you're just kind of presenting these ideas like, well, here they are. These are these ideas. I hope you like them. Like, there's something very sweet and sincere and genuine about the song. I mean, besides the fact that they're super catchy in the best way. Like, I asked, because you played a couple songs for us to put at the end of the podcast, and one of the first things I was like, will they play Lake Michigan? Which is one of my favorite songs of all time.
Thank you.
I don't know what the song is about. I've read the lyrics online along, you know, I've read along with it. I've braved the pop-up ads that come from the lyric reading websites. So, you know, I'm familiar with the lyrics, but I don't know exactly what the song's about.
Well, you know what's funny about that song? They asked us if they could use it for the show Dancing with the Stars.
Uh-huh.
And so I hadn't really seen that show before. So I'm like, yeah, they're going to play it while they're dancing. That's fine. And I didn't realize that there's a band that plays the song. It's not just like recorded music.
Yeah.
And so I'm watching this because it happened. I didn't know that it had aired. So someone sent me a YouTube clip, a YouTube video, you know, and I'm watching it. And I'm just thinking to myself, what were these people thinking in their minds while they're trying to sing these lyrics really fast? Like, I'm thinking, what are these assholes singing about? What is this music? And it was so robotic. They sang it in such like an operatic kind of way. It was so funny.
I think that, like, was probably, it'd be funny if they actually had sheet music in there. Like,
they must have. And it was very surreal for me.
That's so funny.
Can you talk about what the song is about? Do you talk about what the song is about?
I haven't really talked about it before. You know, when we first started really hitting the road a lot, I was exposed to parts of the country that I really hadn't been in before. I'd never been to the Midwest before. I hadn't really traveled that much in the States. And he's a Midwest guy. You know, he was born in Ohio. And he...
True.
Yeah?
Yeah. Lived in Indiana.
And he lived in Indiana.
Near Chicago.
Yeah. And so we were traveling a lot, and I would I was really affected by geography, and I was feeling like feeling the weight of emotional ecological issues, that greed kind of is the tragedy of our country, that we know what our...
Hold up.
That's his lady calling. We know what our problems are. We know what our problems are, but we choose not to fix them, you know? And that was my feelings, that we can identify almost any problem that we have in this country, and we just choose not to fix it, you know? And so there's a lot of stream of conscience in there, but like, get off of my side. It's like, it's saying, you know, I'm going to just take care of myself. And, you know, Lake Michigan is kind of this, to me, this kind of iconic body of water. And it's, everyone lives in this country knows Lake Michigan. And we're poisoning our water. We're poisoning our planet. And we care more about ourselves, you know, short term, than doing anything about it, you know? And so it's kind of, it's sort of esoteric, I know, in a lot of ways, but fundamentally the song is about just being really selfish and deciding just to take care of yourself instead of seeing the larger picture.
So do you have to, first of all, I think it's really funny for you when you start to go, yeah, you know, there's this really this thing about nature and ecology and...
I know, allow me to take this off.
That's really funny.
Really funny. Buy, sell, buy.
But when you're sort of, when you kind of have that moment, that emotional moment where you experience this thing and it strikes you, do you immediately have to start writing the song, or does it kind of sit and percolate for a while?
Well, it's changed. It used to be in the beginning that it had to kind of sit and percolate for a while because I had no real means really to record it. But, you know, when iPhone, the mm-hmm. voice memo app came out, that's totally changed things for me. I can no matter where I am, phone here, if I'm at an amusement park and there are these bells ringing, you know, I can record it, or any kind of melodic idea. If something is, if I'm trying to work out a melody or work out structure or anything on a song, I can always go to the voice memo app. And I was actually talking to Dave Zahn about that with song. And the thing that's really strange about it is I kind of do it all the time, whether it's on guitar at home or just... And what's funny is that I do it a lot and then I forget about it because it's recorded, so I don't have to think about it anymore. And
do you label them?
No. And then I just go back sometimes when I'm driving, I'll like play and listen to them just to kind of try and remember so I can piece them together and make songs out of them. And I feel like I'm sort of like stealing from someone. I'm like, God, who came up with this? I'll take that, you know? And it's really funny, but it's amazing. It's really... It's allowed me to write more music because I can remember more things. And then sometimes I'll take disparate things. Like I'll take that thing and then I'll from that I did 6 months ago and this thing, and then, or even I'll review the notes that I took, and it'll make me think of other things. And it's kind of allowed a lot more ideas to kind of bloom where I wouldn't be able to do it before.
Well, particularly in Lake Michigan, your songs kind of turn in places where you go, oh, where did he think to go that way? Mm. You know, like when you go into the chorus of Lake Michigan, mm-hmm, it just da 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 da. Like it's just like a dip.
Oh yeah.
Like where is it something that you're influenced by, or is it just like, man, that's just how your brain works?
I don't know. I think sometimes it's maybe lack of musical education, where maybe things are supposed to go in a certain way, and I don't have any. I mean, he studied music, but I didn't. And so, and actually, what it comes down to is sometimes I'll like what someone else did in a song. You know, like "Happiness is a Warm Gun." You know, it's just like it's just chopped up things pushed together, and that's what's so neat about it, is it just turns on a dime.
Yeah.
And I like how it did that. And so I imagine maybe I was thinking, well, instead of doing like a pre-chorus and building into the chorus, what if it just it was integrated into it, you know, it just dovetails into the chorus. That way you can't even think about it, you're already there, you know? So I probably just borrowed, stole.
That's interesting to hear you say that, because Ben Bridwell from Band of Horses said that pretty much the same thing to me when they were on the podcast, which was like, he was like, well, I had no musical training, I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to do this or this or this, or not that you shouldn't be trained if you want to be trained, but I think I think if you are trained, at least be able to, you know, kind of have the freedom to go like, no, it's okay to break structure sometimes or pull from other things.
I think it's hard to, though.
It comes from also what you listen to. Like, if you didn't go to school and learn, like, oh, you have to resolve it and whatever, you bands you listen to probably did that too. You mentioned that Beatles song. Mm-hmm. If you love the Beatles or REM or all the bands that you listed in the ad that he put out when I joined the band. Anyway, all, these bands are all too. Like they all do really interesting stuff. And if that's your education, is learning from other bands. And it's like I'm kind of thinking of the Beatles. They didn't have any proper education, but George Martin definitely did, and he helped to whip things that they were doing into shape, because they had all kinds of, you used all kinds of weird chords and strange harmonies, and they were just, it's just because of what they were into.
Well, you know, I think that's one reason why we work as a collaborative pair in the studio, because he has the patience of Job. Because I will come in,
Gob.
Michael. No, but
so good.
What's nice is that I will take I'll demo something, and it's really out of whack rhythmically. It doesn't really always make sense, because I'll be playing something on the guitar, but it's not only when we start bringing in drums do I realize that it doesn't really make sense rhythmically. Instead of him trying to correct it, he actually goes with it. You know, so that something that doesn't make, because I'm working by myself when I'm starting, and then I bring it to him, and he doesn't try to refine it. He tries to just, if it's a strange kind of time signature, he just lets it stay that way. And, you know, and so doing drums after the fact kind of, I think, helps us in not necessarily having it sound like a standard thing, I think.
You know? That's how we worked on this new record. You laid just about everything down, and I would go do drums and just make them fit and hammer them into the song a lot of times.
Yeah.
So the trick is to have a Pat who knows...
Yeah, if you want to have a good band, have Pat be in it, and you are set.
A guy who really understands structure and music theory. And, yeah, you know.
But actually, we just put out this new record, and there's a song called College, which was the first single we put out, and it was exactly like that, where I was working on it by myself, and it kind of had an intro-y thing, and had kind of a long ending, and instead of trying to kind of have it have more of a standard beginning and a standard resolution, we decided just to keep it that way. So it's kind of counterintuitive in terms of being a song and certainly a single, but I kind of like that it just emerges in this way where it kind of sounds like we're not sure where it's going. And actually John Congleton produced it with us, and he's great, but he was saying, you know, it sounds like you're unsure of yourself a little bit when the song is starting. Do you want to do that? And I was like, yeah, I do. You know, I want to sound like you don't really know when it's beginning yet, and you don't really know when it's going to end, and that kind of made
when
it fun
for when we were working
me.
On that, it started with you doing guitar, and I just did that rim thing just to keep time.
Yeah.
And to go back a little bit, we always talk about wanting to keep mistakes, like what would music be without mistakes? What would the Rolling Stones be, especially without mistakes? And we always wanted to keep mistakes and little things, as long as it wasn't a total train wreck.
Right.
Keep it together. That's the music. That's the soul of the band. And so I think we actually did that this time around. We actually did those things we wanted to do.
Yeah. Don't think that your Will Arnett impersonation escaped my attention a second ago when he said Gob and you said Michael.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the one where he's like, he's trying to figure out like who this Hermano is, you know, this guy she's interested in, you know?
You could probably, I find that I can do the best Will Arnett after I've done a long show.
Oh yeah, because you like, got nothing left.
You're,
yeah,
nothing left. You're all, shredded. It's all the yeah. bass, Mike. Yeah, because I've been talking at Comic-Con all like for 4 days straight.
So you got your Will Arnett voice.
You're
right
close.
Now.
Yeah. It is the end result of like hours of panels and podcasts and yelling over at an event, you know. How's Comic-Con going? That's great.
Yeah. Well, actually, no. I realize, you know, I wake up after a show a lot of times. I've got nothing. I have no voice, and I realize it's not even from performing. It's for afterwards when we're just like chatting with everyone, and it's loud. Like, oh my god, I haven't seen you in so long. You know, wonder why I can't speak the next.
Because you see, everyone. Most people use your voice. They use their voice wrong. You're not like they force air out. I do it, which is why my voice always blows out, because you're like, you're not
most
supposed to.
Most people don't scream their conversation. Yeah. They usually have like this. It's very civil.
Yeah.
But if there was a whole crowd and a band in this room right now, we would be done. You know?
Yeah.
That does amaze me though, when you go to a show sometimes and someone wants to tell you something that occurred to them while the band is playing, and so they tell you, and then you realize later, wow, that person was screaming in my ear as loud as they could, and you wouldn't normally do
about
that.
About something that was really probably not that important.
Your ears are crying, and you hear it rattling, your eardrums. Like,
sometimes you know, it hurts, and you plug your ear and then have them yell, and then, okay, that's better. It takes it in.
But you're pretty set. I mean, your singing voice is very similar to your talking voice.
Is it?
To me, it sounds like I can totally. When you talk, I can hear like, oh yeah, that's definitely Zach. That's the guy. Like that's the voice.
Well, that's bad because I've heard my voice on like, voicemail messages before, and I can't. I cringe.
You don't like it?
I think everyone does that, but I really can't stand it. I like, oh man. So I feel like, oh man, I don't want to sound like that.
But it's a register that it doesn't. Does your voice strain when you're on stage? Do you strain at all ever?
I've tried to get better at not doing that, and I found that when I do strain, my voice gets more shrill, which is, I don't think, very pleasing. I found that by trying to learn more about how monitors work and how to really use them and not put too much through the monitor so I can get a clearer vocal, I think I do a better job of that.
Yeah.
And just generally how to use a mic properly instead of when I really want to have a really loud note kind of moving back and just how to have your head close to the mic properly. And I'm trying to get better at that, you know. But I still overdo it because you can think, you know, you can have all your technique down all you want, but
it's the excitement.
There's emotion at the show. We're a lot of times singing about stuff that I feel deeply, and when people are giving you energy back, it's kind of like,
you know, you did,
I kind of overdo it. So.
You did come up with some creative lyrics in LA last night. You were definitely feeling.
I forgot
moments.
A lot of. Yeah, I know. I did that.
I
know.
There might have been an F word in there.
What happened?
Oh,
what did you do?
Oh no, I changed. Yeah, I decided I threw in some F bombs.
So fuck California.
Yeah, I may have said that at a certain point. Yeah.
Fuck Michigan.
No, but there are moments. There are a lot of times when I'm in the middle of a song, like, wow, I just sang the second verse first, and then I'm like, should I sing the second verse the second time, or should I reverse them? But if we're harmonizing together, then I can't exactly.
It's really
I
tough
can't tell them. Yeah.
I've got headphones, so I got just vocals piped in, so I can really hear it. And sometimes trying to follow where he's going, if he's getting creative, I'm like, well.
Yeah, sometimes I just turn around and I'm like, sorry. I just.
You know, it's harder for you guys because.
It's the heat of the moment.
We did, we podcasted Metallica at Comic Con, and James Hetfield said, oh yeah, I got a word wedge. Because I don't remember, you know, it's like he forgets something. Yeah. You know, he's so many songs.
Yeah.
And I go, Yeah, but this is the thing. If you're Metallica, you can kind of go, you know.
Yeah, you can cheat.
But with your music, like, you know, the lyrics are very articulate. And so if you fuck them up, I mean, I guess in a live venue, people are, you know, in the moment, maybe they don't notice, but.
I have seen that happen. For Lake Michigan.
I know, they'll say, I'd be like, I have noticed sometimes where I've completely sang the wrong words, and I've seen people going like, that's wrong.
They're paying attention.
Yeah. It's wrong. I'm like, I know, I'm sorry.
I didn't.
I just forget sometimes, you know.
Well, because I think you can sort of get into a habit. This happens with jokes too, where you can get into a pattern where it just comes out. You don't even think about it, and then every once in a while you'll kind of go, "Huh, what if I thought about that? Oh shit, I can't remember it," because it's almost like it's in a different part of your brain. It's in a different chamber of your brain, and when you think about it, you couldn't repeat it.
Yeah, and that's why. It's very hard for me a lot of times sound checking or doing certain things we do like promo, like radio promo or something, because it's divorced from the actual show. Because when we're playing and it's like a real show, you're in a different emotional state where you feel the weight of the moment. And if you don't feel it, if you're just sound checking, like, well, it's a sound check, you know. So I'm not in that place. I can't really. I'm not a trained singer. So if there isn't the emotional component there, then it feels like. I can't really go through the motions very effectively because it feels fraudulent, you know? So in a soundtrack, I'll be like, I'm kind of doing it, but...
I have a question. Was that Lake Michigan recorded?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I did some...
some jazzing.
Well, that's also a chance because we do songs every night pretty much the same way. Yeah. It gives you a chance to get jazzy, because it's not for anybody, it's for you. And you're just checking and warming up and playing. So
yeah, you were trying on Nurse Manation. You were really kind of...
I was doing some... the place to do it.
You're fucking around.
He was
playing around.
Yeah, you're playing some hip-hop.
Is there any...
hip-hop jams.
Can you... You know, if you're on stage, if you're not feeling it for whatever, you know, sometimes, you know, energy just doesn't feel right, like it's connecting. Do you have a trick to kind of get back in, or do you... Is the trick just to sort of let it be what it is and
whiskey?
The trick is whiskey.
Yeah, no, I don't know. You know, we didn't really tour for about 3 years. We just started up again, and part of this process of playing again is kind of trying to remember how to read a room, or try to know how to read a room. Sometimes I think I really can. Other times I'm like Or I'm wondering in the middle of a song, is the energy lost, or are we moving, you know, and kind of an awareness of how people are collectively feeling. I've been trying to get back into that, and I found sometimes if I feel like it's a little dead, I try and play a little quieter sometimes and see if the quieter, if it's a quiet song, if we get quieter, then they'll stop, you know. But you know what's funny, and I don't know if you experience this when you're performing, but in the age of phones, you know, I remember one time we did this thing, we did a promo thing that's like ad agency, which always feels like awful. Like the principal is like
we
asking.
We just did that one in Portland. Yeah. It was pretty awful.
Yeah, but we did, and I noticed there were like some people are just like, you know, just on their phones like this. And I mentioned something, you know, during it. I was like, wow, that's not very nice. You know, it's kind of rude. Yeah. But I realized that some people there, they were so excited, they wanted people to know
that they were there.
And they were, like, posting on Twitter or whatever, like, they were glad, they were saying the songs that were being played.
They were saying this,
you know?
Rogue Wave is playing in my office right now. Like, the singer just called me out.
Yeah.
Gotta go. You.
Yeah.
What a dick.
Actually, we were in Pittsburgh recently, and this one dude wanted to film this song, and he had this flash on, and it was so bright. It was like the sun was searing my eyes. It was so bright. And in the middle of the song, I just walked up to him and I just took his phone and I turned it off
Pittsburgh.
And we gave back to him in Pittsburgh, and I felt bad for him because everyone kind of was mad at him.
You know,
at that
as
point.
A rock
but
band,
I was like,
you could have grabbed that thing and just smashed it into a million pieces and then gone back into the riff, and then I think everyone would have been happy.
Yeah, I would have felt
I bad. Think,
but I don't know if that affects you when you're performing, if you see people.
That's an expensive flashlight.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes, you know, if you can mistake people listening for people not, you know, and they're like, oh, no, we were listening, you know, but I do think that an audience needs to understand that it just has. I think there's a 10% responsibility that the audience has, which is to be willing to be engaged in the show. Mm. Now, it's your responsibility as a performer to take that and build off it, but I do think the audience needs to come in a little bit willing. It can't be like, win me over, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they have to make just a tiny hair of an effort to sort of form this relationship that you have as the performer and the audience. And if they don't do that, sometimes audiences are just bad together. Like, you'll get a specific group of people, it's just not a good audience again. You hear comics say to them, like, if you ever get an opportunity to be an audience together again, don't do it.
Yeah, that was, we'll call that Toronto. But what's funny is that was always us for LA. Anytime we'd go to LA, I always felt like it was just like, you know, yeah, win me over. But now when we go there, it's really great. So
can
I don't know what changed.
What it's going to be like in... I don't know how many years, when everyone is so used to multitasking and social networking is just everything that you do. And someone comes to a show, you just go look out at the audience, it's all going to be this, because they're like telling their...
I am enjoying the show.
I'm relating to this right now.
I'm relating to the show.
Or taking pictures or film or even who knows what it's going to be, but eventually that's all people are going to know.
Yeah.
My audience does this, and you know, it's going to be strange.
Yeah.
It is getting strange.
Well, it definitely is, you know, I think it is our responsibility as performers to keep trying to engage the audience as much as possible. And when you have a bad show, you know, don't you think you could have a good show by another person's perspective, but you kind of go, I didn't really do what I wanted to do. And so you've taken it as a loss, even though the crowd might have really kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, I think the better we feel about shows as a tour goes on, the more I tend to analyze it, and so little things that I'll feel like we didn't do it the way we wanted to, I will obsess about that, and then I'll feel like we failed. But maybe maybe we did.
Well, and you can also have a show that where you didn't connect with the audience at all, but you guys did everything you wanted to do.
And then you feel good about it.
You feel good about it, yeah.
Or you know what's funny about it is we can have a show where I'm just a series of fuck-ups. Everything I do, my voice will crack, everything's out of tune, all these strange things happen, people love it, and they like the mistakes. And then I can play a show where I think it was, like, flawless, like, I sang really well, and everything went right, and, like, nothing. But, like, so, what do I learn from that?
Well,
I need to make more, you know.
No, I'll tell you what I think it is. I'll tell you what I think it is, which is that I think as a culture, we're not impressed by perfection anymore because it can be faked. Yeah. Like perfection, you know, like perfection, things can be auto-tuned, things can be down to just the molecule perfected. Mm-hmm. And so I think people are bored with it. And so when there are mistakes and when there are flaws, that's organic and that's an experience that we're all having together.
That's
and
a
that
person.
makes it special and unique, well, and it's very humanizing.
It bonds those people who come together. They're like, you remember when we saw Rogue Wave or whatever band? And like I saw Not a Surf a year and a half ago. And Daniel, the bass player, his bass broke down. And the show was just paused. But they did all these, like, oddball songs they never do. Matthew and Ira did these songs. While somebody left the Fillmore and went and got a bass out of her apartment and brought it in and gave it to him. That was just an amazing show because this event happened.
They were forced to be creative. They were forced to kind of think outside the normal routine,
which
is good.
And that was Philly. We were our keyboard player. Something went wrong. Everything broke in his keys, and I didn't know what to do. He had to fix it, you know. And he couldn't. We couldn't be playing with him, like, you know. So I was like, okay.
How about this?
He was like, oh man. I was like, shit. What are we gonna do?
It's like Scotty and the engineer. Yeah. Oh, I'm working on it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, okay, put on your mining light, you know, on your forehead, and fix it. And so I didn't know what to do. So I didn't have my acoustic guitar because I'd left it. It was somewhere else. And so I just grabbed this hollow body electric and it was unplugged and I was like, all right. And I just sat at the edge of the stage and played that song, California.
Yes.
It wasn't even plugged in. I didn't grab a mic. And that was a pretty big room. What was that place in Philly called?
Union Transfer.
Yeah. And so, and that was what everyone was writing about, was that part of the show. So nothing we rehearsed. Not, you know, that was the thing they wanted to talk about, because it was kind of crazy, because I had to kind of yell it to the entire room. But people in the back room said they could hear that guitar, just like the hollow body, just nothing plugged in.
You know, so we need to go work on our mistakes real soon.
Yeah, you guys have to get out of here because you have your show starting soon.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to try to bring it full circle with like what's going to keep people engaged with live shows when they're multitasking.
Yeah.
And it's going to be Kiss.
I knew it.
Blood and fire and explosions. Now, did Journey ever do that? I don't know. It was just tight pants and a leather jacket,
dude,
and white tennis shoes.
All I know is the wheel in the sky keeps on turning.
Journey was too busy writing good songs to trifle with that. Like, we'll write melodies and see what happens.
Here's
with
what
that.
Happened at a Kiss concert. Oh my god, I can't believe I just got blood spat on me.
Yeah.
This is so cool.
Yeah, Journey, Doc, I had this amazing emotional moment.
And everyone's still going to be texting.
Basically, we just live in an age where people want to share their experiences. And they have a good time. They just want everyone to know.
But then they want to share experiences so much they're not actually having the experiences.
I know. Parents are always
when they're like this.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I was like that at Comic-Con, just fucking taking pictures of everything and tweeting everything. It's like, no, stop and experience the thing. Then maybe you can share with people, or don't, so that it's just your experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's keep it that way. But you guys, is the album's called Nightingale Floors?
Yeah.
And it just came out in June. And, you know, but I recommend, if you have not heard of Rogue Wave, Descended Like Vultures, Asleep at Heaven's Gate. Like, I'm such a huge fan. And thank you for allowing me to gush on you. And thank you for letting us record your sound check and then come back into the train yard. And who's rehearsing right now?
They're called Hey Marseille. They're
cool.
From Seattle.
Cool.
And I feel bad. They're a 7-piece band. And
oh,
all of our crap is on the show. Like, they are pushed against the monitors because they have so many
people. I think that helps keep you. When you're in tight quarters like that, you play better because you're with your guys or girls or whatever.
If your elbows are touching, you're.
I just think that makes it much like we have a. If our stage is huge, we'll still set up really small because he likes to have my bass drum all up in his back grills.
Yeah, nice. It makes more sense when I can hear the cymbals and drums right behind me. So. Yeah.
Well, so are you guys Rogue Wave on Twitter?
On Twitter, Rogue Wave Band.
Rogue Wave Band.
Yeah.
All one word.
Yeah, and us.
Is Rogue Wave actually like an oceanography institute that studies like actual rogue waves?
Yeah, there's that, and there's a software company.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff there. But yeah, Rogue Wave Band.
Cool.
And I think it's Rogue Wave Music. Our website is Rogue Wave Music. But
yeah.
Twitter and Instagram is Rogue Wave Band.
Excellent. Cool. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Mine. Yeah.
Good to see you guys.
Yeah.
Enjoy
thanks.
The burrito, everyone.
Thanks. I want to thank you. I know Orphan Black because of you.
Oh,
you had Tatiana. Is that her name?
Yeah, Tatiana Maslany.
What an amazing actor! She is incredible on that show.
Yes,
I am blown away by that show.
A lot of people have been talking about that show lately, and
she's good.
It just sort of like, I think you know, after the season played out, a bunch of people were like, "Holy shit!" And they really, you know, Orphan Black has really become a show, which I'm so happy for BBC America.
Yeah, well, I saw. I think it was the first episode.
Yeah.
And I saw she was a guest, and I was like, who is this person? I don't know this show. And so my wife and I started watching it right then, and we're into it. It's great.
That's awesome.
And also, the Rob Zombie, the last one you did with
yeah.
him. I love Rob Zombie. I didn't know you guys are friends.
Yeah.
About that. And I have this kind of weird obsession with him. I'm just he drawn to his...
Rob Zombie for Halloween one year.
I did.
Oh,
I did
awesome.
Dress as Rob once. It was really awesome. But anyway, I really...
Like the Hellbilly Rob Zombie or like the old... The Dracula Rob Zombie? Like which
the,
Rob
the
Zombie?
The older Rob Zombie. And I had dreads and I looked pretty good actually when I did that. But anyway, I really enjoyed that. It was such a great conversation. I love hearing... I like hearing how you guys... talk about art and motivation and being true to yourself and but both how you guys were talking about each other and it was just it was really a nice conversation.
I really appreciate that.
I listen to your podcast all the time.
Oh, thanks, man. I'm honored. And now I think we have to. Oh, and I'm going to present you with t-shirts.
Oh, yeah.
There's a stack of Nerdist t-shirts.
We didn't know what's in there.
You can't wear them all at the same time.
And,
cool.
Give me the stack.
You gave me a stack.
I gave you a stack.
Yeah.
And now, of course, you guys have to cover Dracula in one of your next shows.
I know.
Okay. We got to figure that out.
How would you cover Dracula?
Well, you know, we've actually been doing a bunch of covers lately, a bunch of 80s covers, and I don't know, we'll have to go back to our lab at home and figure that out.
Yeah.
Maybe acoustic.
It would almost, you know, dig through the ditches, burn through the witches. Like, you could almost throw it in California.
Make it our own. Yeah, I've never tried that before.
Well, we do that with covers anyway. We try to do something... Completely. We do a cover of a Screaming Trees song. I nearly lost.
Oh, it's one of my favorite. I fucking love Screaming Trees.
Oh, maybe we'll do that tonight. We'll do that.
We should have done did it at.
We played it last night. You know what we do a lot of times. You know that South Park episode. You know, they took our jobs.
They took our jobs.
We sing that into every song when we're riding in our van. We take that into every. We took it. It goes into every song.
But I love in that episode when they go so overboard. It's like there's no words.
So, but you can put that. You can sing about how they're taking your jobs in every song.
That's fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Of course,
it's awesome.
Yeah,
man.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Have a good show.
And yeah, and hopefully. To go to Comic-Con.
Are you going
to
be at the show?
I can't. I have to get back. I'm flying to Montreal tomorrow morning from San Diego. So I have to get back to this. Comic-Con has been a fucking blur. If you guys were any closer than Solana Beach, I would have.
It's far.
It's about 20.
Traffic.
Yeah.
Oh. Like leaving Comic-Con.
I wanted to be at that thing.
I'm staying in LA tonight because I don't want to deal with San Diego. We have stuff in LA tomorrow, so I'm just gonna.
I'm kind of heartbroken that I can't stay for the show because that was the one thing where, oh, it'll be perfect, go podcast, I'll stay for the show. That's it. And then I found out, I mean, like, our fucking hotel room from my girlfriend and I, it's just because you're running in, like, give me this. It's like a fucking
tornado.
Yes, there's just shit everywhere. And we never let housekeeping come in this trip because it's like, I don't want them to organize anything. Everything's out where I need it.
Yeah, I don't like housekeeping coming in. I like keeping my room. I don't like other meddling folks.
Maybe help explain this. Why do housekeepers come in and they accentuate keeping?
Housekeeping.
Yeah.
What is that?
I don't know.
That's a weird
housekeeping.
Because you're not in your house.
Right. Yeah. And housekeeping.
Maybe they feel a subtle amount of guilt that you're not in your house.
It's almost like
housekeeping. It is a little bit of a weird. I'm here to clean your room. Whoa.
Sorry.
Mommy,
too
fluff pillow. I hope to go to Comic-Con. I've never gone.
You should. It is a wonderful experience, and the vibe, just for being someone who seems very sincere and celebratory, and it is totally in your wheelhouse. So maybe
you know, maybe if anyone's listening to this podcast and you work for a company and you want to bring Rogue Wave to play at Comic-Con, at a Comic-Con party next year, that's what you guys should kind of look into. Because Kirkman hired Weezer to play the Walking Dead party, and it was fucking great, and they played everything you wanted to hear.
Oh, yeah.
So I feel like a Rogue Wave could make an appearance at Comic-Con next year.
For a while, between tours, I worked at Image Comics in Berkeley.
Oh, shit!
And I got to meet Robert Kirkman because he came around and took us all out to lunch.
Yeah.
And so, but my job was shelving and categorizing comic books. So I was sat in a room with stacks of comics and just be like reading by myself with like a CD player and just like But Walking Dead is something I just kept up on and love.
Yeah, I downloaded issue 112, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet because I haven't had a moment at the con. But it's
the con.
It's good. The con. Hope to see you there next year.
Yeah, I'd love to go. I really want to go. So.
Cool.
Thanks, guys.
Ooh, even is a sister that she wanna fight. She would even miss it if you thought it's hot. No one politician leaning to the right. If it's gonna feel so good, you wanna grow up with that. Get off the back. Listen, no war. Go along yourself a million miles. Open up the colors and out. And you go up the bat. Beat all the guys.
Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuge, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.